Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and it's time for Between the Covers. We've been following a Toronto man's journey in search of his long-lost uncle. Leo Nolan is the narrator of Terence Greene's novel Shadow of Ashland. His mother's dying wish had been to see her brother Jack one more time. Jack had left Depression-era Toronto looking for employment in the U.S., then had disappeared for 50 years. After Leo's mother's death, letters from Jack began arriving, all dated 1934, and postmarked Ashland, Kentucky. Intrigued, Leo takes a road trip to Ashland and checks into the now shabby Scott Hotel where his uncle had stayed. There he meets owners Stan and Teresa Matusik, who knew Jack 50 years earlier. He also meets a friendly waitress named Jean. Leo's invited her and her son Adam out for dinner. Here's Michael Hogan reading from Shadow of Ashland.
We went up the steps onto the porch of the modest frame bungalow and opened the wooden screen door. Mom, in here. We went inside. Mrs. Burney was a small, portly woman in a large house dress. She looked at me curiously. Mom, this is Leo Nolan. I held out my hand. Pleased to meet you. Nice to meet you. Her hand was warm. Jean glanced around. Where's Adam?
Down at the lot with Kenny.
Good.
Thanks. See you tomorrow morning.
She kissed her mother on the cheek, squeezed her shoulder, and headed back toward the front door. I followed. Nice meeting you, Mrs. Burney.
Pleasure.
She watched us as we went through the screen door. I thought I saw a smile on her face. The lot turned out to be a vacant, fenced-in parking lot, adjacent to a boarded-up factory. There were two kids in it, one hitting fly balls, the other catching and fielding them.
Adam!
Jean raised her arm. The kid in the field put his hand over the visor of his cap, then trotted over, a tiny imitation of every major league fielder headed for the bench that he had ever seen on TV. His mother bent down and gave him a quick kiss on the side of the head. Ignoring her, he waved to his friend, who waved back.
Adam, this is Mr. Nolan.
How are you doing, Adam? I held out my hand. He looked out at me from under his Cincinnati Reds cap, then shook my hand.
Fine,
he said. We're going to dinner with Mr. Nolan. He looked from one to the other of us. But you get to pick the place. His mother waited. He brightened.
McDonald's, he announced.
I looked at Jean for a signal of some sort. She smiled at him and then turned to me, still smiling. McDonald's it is then, I said.
All right,
Adam Burney pounded his tiny fist into his baseball glove for emphasis. What are you going to get? She asked me as we got in line. Not sure. I was reading the menus behind the cashiers.
I want a quarter pounder with cheese, fries, and a Coke,
announced Adam. You got kids, she said to me. You got this menu memorized. We sat down, and the eyes from under the baseball cap peered up at me inquisitively. Nice glove, I said, trying it on for size. Got a good pocket.
Cost me $49, on sale.
I just about died, interrupted his mother.
Can you believe it? $49.
Adam glanced from one to the other of us, stuffing the French fries into his mouth with his hands. I shifted my index finger outside the leather at the back for support, flexing it open and closed. Good quality, I said. Will last a lifetime. He can give it to his son someday. It'll still be good. In fact, it will be better, worked in. It's a beauty, I said, handing it back to him. There was no answer, but he continued to smile. Who do you like on the Reds, I asked.
Dave Parker, he said. Mario Soto?
Great players, I said.
You from Toronto?
It was Adam's first real attempt to communicate with me. I stopped chewing, pleased.
Yep. You watch the Blue Jays?
Sometimes.
Who do you know in the Jays? Dave Steeb? Lloyd Mosby?
Good men, I said.
Jays are pretty good this year, he said, for a change.
And the Reds are kind of disappointing, aren't they?
Ooh, they got Pete Rose back, though.
His face was hopeful. It's a good move. He'll help. Bring some zip to the club. They can use it. Adam hollowed his cheeks, sipping his Coke through the straw, not taking his eyes from me. Jean sat back, watched the play-by-play, smiled. We stopped outside a two-story frame house, painted pale blue. It still wasn't dark. "This is it," she said. "We rent the upstairs." The three of us formed a comfortable triangle on the sidewalk. Jean placed her hand on her son's shoulder. I sighed, looked around, put my hands in my pockets. 40 years old, I thought, you never quite get the hang of it. "Thanks for the company," I said. Jean smiled. "Thank you," she said. "It was very nice." "Thanks," said Adam. I tugged his cap down over his face playfully. He giggled and pushed it back up. "It's Detroit this year, I think, all the way. Morris, Gibson, Hernandez, who's going to stop them?" He listened, all ears, the big glove dangling from his small left hand. I looked at Jean. "I'm here for a bit longer. Maybe we can do it again." "I'd like that." I held out my hand. She took it warmly, firmly. Sometimes what we become and where we end up is of greater surprise to ourselves than it is to others. Plans get skewered. Logic falters. We become human, terribly so. Stumble, try to recover, fail, choose another direction and move onward. Shadow and sunshine, the road behind us disappearing, the one ahead unknowable. It was 1 a.m. I could not sleep. The streets of Ashland led in all directions as I walked in the summer night. My footsteps were silent. At night, the King's Daughters Hospital on Lexington Avenue is any hospital in any city. Beneath a streetlight, a cab driver sat, his left arm propped out the window, a newspaper folded against the steering wheel. He eyed me briefly as I stood with my hands in my pockets, looking past him to the building. A young man came out the front door, stood a moment, oblivious of both of us. At a distance and in the dark, his features were blurred. Early 20s, I guessed. The short sleeves of his white shirt hung from his elbows as he lifted his hands to run them through black, curly hair. He turned and walked with an unhurried gait up the street. I began to follow him. I could offer no reason even to myself for doing so. It just began to happen, like everything else. With silent footsteps, the air thick, we sauntered through the pools of incandescent haze spilling down from the street lamps, him leading, me trailing, 100 or so feet apart. I dared not develop the thoughts that had begun to stir, like leaves eddying in my brain. They made no sense. The young man with the dark curly hair continued onward, oblivious of my presence. When he crossed the deserted street and headed north on 14th, I stopped momentarily, a rush of adrenaline making me lightheaded. Then I, too, crossed and headed north, my thoughts swirling. He stopped outside the Scott Hotel. Behind him, I slowed, holding my breath. He glanced up at it, hands in pockets, then moved on. I followed. He turned right and walked along Winchester, stopping again to stare at the monumental First Bank and Trust Company building. My eyes strayed from him to gaze at the tall first floor of the edifice, its decorative windows, its columns set in antis between wide corner piers. Then I tilted my head back, absorbing the upper stories, noting the broadly projecting copper cornice at the top. When I looked back at where he had stood, he was gone. The street was empty in both directions. The next morning, after showering and dressing, I walked back to where I had last seen the young man. I stood on the sidewalk, at the exact spot. I looked across at the First Bank and Trust Company building, playing out the moment before he had vanished. The building told me nothing. Below me, though, the sidewalk was broken, where it had sunk over the years. The earth, I thought, and looked down. It's as though it swallowed him up. Emma Matusik opened the door to her family's living quarters when she heard me come in the front. "Mr. Nolan?" I looked up. "Message for you. Phone while you're out." She handed me a piece of paper. It was from Jean. There were two phone numbers. One said work, the other home. I smiled. Then I saw Emma Matusik eyeing me curiously. There was something else she wanted to say. "There's some stuff," she began. in the back here that you're welcome to. A couple of years ago, we bought some things with the idea of updating some of the rooms, but the plan never got too far. She shrugged. My father just wanted an excuse to buy some modern gizmos, I figure. She went back inside her apartment. I followed her through the open door. It took two trips to carry them to the third floor. I lugged the small bar fridge up to room number 8 first, then returned for the microwave. They were both brand new. The Matusiks hadn't even bothered to remove them from their cardboard boxes. I set the microwave on top of the chest of drawers and the fridge on the floor beside it, plugged them both in, then sat back in the blue easy chair to enjoy the spectacle of my new domesticity. A fellow, I thought, could stay here quite a while. And Emma, for some reason, seemed to want me to. This one's dated September 30th, 1934. The line carrying my father's voice from Toronto was clean and clear. Dear Margaret, I've been here for more than 3 months now, and it's really beginning to feel like home. Me, a southerner. Can you believe it? Still trying to get ahead, Marg. In fact, I'm involved in something here that has lots of promise, so keep your fingers crossed. Some of the fellows here at the Scott have a project that's very interesting. The man who runs the hotel has agreed that it makes sense, too. And with his help, something is really possible. But enough of this. I've been reading a book called The Moon and Sixpence, which I got from the library. It's about a fellow who abandons his home and family to be an artist. I have to admit, there's a part of me that understands exactly what he's doing and why. The rat race for money and staying one step ahead of the guy behind you is enough to wear anyone down. But I'm no artist, Marg. Heck, I can't even paint a house. It's just past dinner time, and I'm going with a friend to the movies tonight. King Kong is playing at the Paramount. It should be fun, and I can sure use some fun. Say hello to everyone for me, okay? Lots of love. Your brother, Jack. There was nothing to say. Jack, I thought. Where are you? At Woolworth's, I bought a microwavable plate, a drinking glass, a mug, and a set of stainless steel cutlery. Before leaving, I went and sat down at the counter in front of Jean. She was serving a customer, but caught my eye and smiled. How you doing? She leaned forward on her hands. I got your message. She shrugged. Pretty bold of me. Her hair fell out from behind her ear. But I figured, what the heck, you seemed like a decent guy, and decent guys don't grow on trees. I'm glad you called. She looked relieved. Listen, she said, I was wondering about tomorrow evening. I waited. Seeing as how you took us to dinner, I was hoping you'd let me take you to dinner. Just the two of us. Show you some Kentucky hospitality. I know a nice place. I smiled, knowing what it took to make such an overture. My pleasure, I said. She stood back and straightened, her confidence restored. Great. My mom offered to keep Adam for the evening. The loose strand of hair got tucked back behind her ear. Give me time to get home, get changed. Can you come by 7:30? I'll be there. Now it was her eyes that smiled. I can't believe I'm doing this. Feels good when it works out, doesn't it? It does, she said, nodding. It surely does. At a 7-Eleven, I bought a jar of instant coffee, a container of orange juice, 6 Pepsis, some bananas, milk, cream, sugar, and a box of Cheerios. Then, to diversify my cuisine, I tossed in 2 frozen dinners and a frozen pizza. At ABC Drive-Thru Liquors, I bought 6 cans of Miller Lite. I had my novel, the TV in my room, and I wouldn't be seeing Jean until tomorrow night. Like Jack said, I thought, a fella's gotta do something with his spare time. I microwaved the frozen dinner and drank 2 cans of Miller Lite while I watched a ball game on the TV. Then I fell asleep during the news, my novel open on my chest. When I woke, Carson was ending, and groggily I rose and switched it off. Nighttime. At last. I went to the window and drew it in through my pores. I had been waiting for it. At 1 a.m., I was standing across from the King's Daughters Hospital. He came out the front door, just like last night. I held my breath. The only sound was that of his footsteps as he strode down Lexington, Central Park on his right, some of the fairer manors of Ashland on his left. It was a replay. He turned right, heading north on 14th Street. I followed. For the five blocks between Lexington and Winchester, it was as though the rest of the world had been sealed off, while we, the two of us alone, moved through a blackness that crackled with possibility. When he stopped at the Scott, I stopped. And when he turned along Winchester, I turned too. Across from the First Bank and Trust Company building, he paused, put his hands in his pockets, and stood in contemplation. Again, I watched, hypnotized, afraid to lose him a second time. Then he turned and met my gaze. We stared at one another, without fear, without suspicion. The air was truly alive now, and I felt my heart beat with a wonder and certainty that it had never known. Jack Rady stood before me, a young man in his early 20s. I knew it was him. I could tell by the jaw, the cheekbones, the dark black hair. He was a Rady, my mother's brother, my uncle. He smiled. He put his hands in his pockets and smiled, full of wonder and delight and youth. It was a perfect moment, one of the few that we are allotted in our lifetimes. A moment when the eons needed to transform coal into diamond contract with the purity of quicksilver. 1934 or 1984? When I blinked, he was gone, as I knew he would be. And I was once more alone in the night.
That was Michael Hogan with episode 4 of Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, time begins to warp when Leo has an actual conversation with a young Jack Rady. In our poetry nightcap, I have a poem about a somewhat ghostly presence and the strong effect it has on the person who's visited by it. The Call was written by the British writer Charlotte Mew. It's read by Donna Goodhand.
The Call. From our low seat beside the fire, where we have dozed and dreamed and watched the glow, or raked the ashes, stopping so we scarcely saw the sun or rain above, or looked much higher than this same quiet red or burnt-out fire. Tonight, we heard a call, a rattle on the windowpane, a voice on the sharp air, and felt a breath stirring our hair, a flame within us, something swift and tall, swept in and out, and that was all. Was it a bright or a dark angel? Who can know? It left no mark upon the snow, but suddenly it snapped the chain, unbarred, flung wide the door, which will not shut again. And so we cannot sit here anymore. We must arise and go. The world is cold without, and dark and hedged about with mystery and enmity and doubt. But we must go. Though yet we do not know who called or what marks we shall leave upon the snow.
Donna Goodhand reading Charlotte Mew's poem, The Call. Mew was a contemporary of Thomas Hardy, who considered her the best female poet of her generation. We found that poem in the anthology, A Poem a Day, published by Steerforth Press. And that's our program for this evening, but before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available through Goose Lane Editions. Selected readings from past seasons of the program are available on CD or on cassette. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-9-COVERS. That's 1-888-926-8377. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and after that, it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.